All right, let's do hour number two of the Bible study, the Ask the Pastor Hour, the open phone hour. Sitting here in the comfort of Studio A, looking through the glass at the sunshine outside. Why, it looks warm, but it's not. At least it's not outside. It's 6 above here, but warmer than it is in Seward, Nebraska this morning. That's where Concordia University is located. And our guest today, the Reverend Dr. Paul Holtorf, is a professor at Concordia University, where it's colder than it is here. What's the temperature there, Dr. Holtorf?
It is 1 degree above zero, Chuck.
One above zero. Well, the good news is if you can lose that degree, it's zero, which is an accomplishment of some kind, I think.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody's going to be too happy about it, though.
So have you checked the weather to the west there? You're probably one day away from what they've got. Is it warmer to the west?
It will warm up for us in the next about 2 days from now, but for now we just have to make sure that we stay close to a heater.
I've never been out to Seward. I know it seems like no small a number of kids who have gone to Concordia mm-hmm. over the years, and the campus is it can be windy there, I understand.
Yes, it can.
It's kind of out there on the plain, as they say.
There's not much stopping the wind. That's correct.
So what have your wind chills been like?
Oh, anywhere from 15 to 30 below zero.
Is this, I know it can get chilly out there in mm-hmm. Nebraska. Is this typical, or is this colder than you've had in a while?
It's typical. We have been spoiled in the last few winters, so this what makes it tough this time because it's actually cold. The other previous winter has been pretty mild for us.
Well, our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Let's try to keep the conversation warm here as much as possible. Dr. Holtorf, do you have children?
I do. Two boys.
Two boys. How old are they?
11 and 8.
11 and 8. And when you were growing up, I guess you probably grew up in a pretty traditional home, mom, dad, right?
That's correct.
The news contains a story, actually, that I found yesterday that I thought might be worthy of your attention. The headline is By, and that's Evan By. He is senator in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Evan By makes a recommendation to President-elect Barack Obama, and that is to recruit NFL retired football coach Tony Dungy to promote responsible fatherhood. Here's the story. Perhaps caught up in Super Bowl fever, Senator Evan By says he wants outgoing Indianapolis Colts coach Tony Dungy to be President-elect Barack Obama's point man for promoting responsible fatherhood. It's unclear exactly what he wants Dungy to do in that role, but as Washington has a czar for almost everything, a fatherhood czar might not be far off. Here's a quote from By. Tony Dungy won a Super Bowl and took our Colts to the playoffs for 7 straight years. But the greatest measure of this man is what he has done off the field. He is a hero to all of us who care about fostering responsible fatherhood. He is a hero to advocates and foster families trying to give children loving homes through adoption. He is a hero to scores of young Hoosiers in Indianapolis for whom he has played a personal role in their lives. First question I want to ask you is, mm-hmm. what is the state of our culture, Dr. Holtorf, that makes it at least sound like a worthy notion that we need a fatherhood czar?
Well, I think part of the state of the culture is the fact that in some circles, parenthood is basically interchangeable. It doesn't matter if you have both a father and a mother or two moms or two dads. There would be some that say, well, it doesn't really matter that we need a father per se, as long as we have parents who are warm and caring and welcoming and loving. This is interesting because others in the same culture might say, indeed, it does matter that you have a dad and a mom. And to lift up the role of fatherhood here, I think, strengthens the argument that you do need a dad just like you need a mom.
Was your dad a positive influence in your life?
He was.
Mm-hmm. Are you trying to follow in his footsteps as you parent your two boys?
I'm trying. The greatest piece of advice he'd ever given me was simply this: love goes a long ways. And that has been something that I have tried, have failed, but have tried at times along the way to foster within our family.
When you were young in school, I don't know if you played any sports or not.
I did, yeah.
You did? Okay, so there's the possibility that some of your teachers, maybe somebody at church, maybe one of your coaches, was also a father figure to you. That mm-hmm. sometimes happens. Do you mm-hmm. have any recollection of anybody filling that role?
Definitely. Pastor Fred Herwig, who's pastor in the Missouri District currently, served as that father figure role for me as I contemplated going to Concordia and the pastoral office along the way. From time to time, we still have phone conversations, which, again, just shows the depth and I think the value that I've always placed on that type of relationship. He's just one of many that I've had. Coaches along the way too, but those seem to kind of fade away. But this one with Pastor Herwig has always been there. One other one that comes to mind too, formation wise. Was Pastor Henry Simon, who was my field ed pastor while I was a student at seminary in St. Louis.
So what makes a father figure, Dr. Holtorf? What are the qualities that you identify in somebody that would cause you to say, yeah, he's a father figure for me?
Well, I think at the top of the list would be this sense of unconditional love, that there is love in that relationship regardless of action, that it's not going to be conditional, that even if there are going to be mistakes made, misunderstandings, words said, that love will always be that common uniting point. And not just a love, you know, like a human love, but to know that God's love in Jesus Christ is there for all of us involved. I think that for me is the top point of the list. You know, and after that is a sense of modeling of how a person relates to other people. Fathers are always going to be watched. They're being watched by their children, and in good and bad situations, the father has an opportunity to model publicly.
What are the children watching for?
A sense does dad show respect to other people? Does dad love his wife? I mean, do they like my mom? Does he shower our mother with care and love? And there's those kinds of traits too that in this modeling process kids are a keen eye to along the way.
So is there a real clear distinction between father figure and mother figure, or are they all at the end of the day just parents?
Well, see, I think that's the challenge, Chuck, and I think that's the challenge culture is kind of forcing upon us if we the church don't set out some definitions of what does a father figure mean, what does a mother figure mean, and to that I think Scripture helps us out along the way. I do believe that in Scripture, fathers do have a unique sense of leadership within that family. Not a dominating kind of leadership to the exclusion of the mother, but the father has as his responsibility to take care of everyone that he's been entrusted with, and especially fathers in terms of discipline or correction. To make sure that is not too harshly given out, because fathers are again to ultimately show that love to that family.
Well, one of the things that parents have to do with their children is to create and establish boundaries
mm-hmm.
so that the children are protected. Sometimes the children don't particularly care for the boundaries, but the parents establish those boundaries because the kids need to learn how to function within them so that they can be safe and
mm-hmm.
so that they can grow into responsible adults. As it pertains to the establishment of boundaries, and then the maintaining of those boundaries. I realize that there are important parental roles. Are in that context, is the work the same for dad as it is for mom?
Yes, and consistency, I think, is the key in the establishment of the boundaries. As long as mom and dad are on the same page in terms of boundaries, I think that will be recognized by the children. And then it doesn't matter whether dad said it or mom said it. Both mom and dad are on the same page when it comes to setting those boundaries.
But at least in the older days, I guess not universally true, but commonly held that what mom would say when the boundaries went down was something like, just wait till your father gets home. So what does that tell us about fatherhood in that context?
Well, I think in that context it says that the father is the sole voice, the judge and determiner of any punishment or any kind of decision. And I'm not so sure that that's always been a helpful model. I think what we find ourselves today, socialization-wise, both men and women, fathers and mothers, having to negotiate that out, because the mother was the primary caretaker at home in that model. Today, it could be a shared process of child rearing between the father and the mother. And so that's why the consistency of those boundaries today are more important than maybe what they would have been a generation or two ago.
Now that families are not as intact as they used to be,
mm-hmm.
and that old model is gone,
mm-hmm.
it seems that one of the problems that has emerged is that mom can't restrain her teenage boy.
Mm-hmm.
If the teenage boy decides to flex his muscles, puberty arrives,
mm-hmm.
and he is getting in touch with his manhood, it's overwhelming to moms in many cases. Now, am I being stereotypical here, or is this accurate?
No, I think it's accurate. Yeah.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, then if it is accurate, if that is a fair assessment, then that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because if dad is not there, either because dad is irresponsible or there's been a divorce or whatever it is, then mom is at a distinct disadvantage there. She's not going to be able to rein this kid in.
Right.
Those boundaries are going to go down.
Right.
And when they go down, there's going to be trouble.
Right. And I think that only probably adds to the credence of maybe having a fatherhood czar. I mean, because it at least people within the society, the movers and the shakers, decision makers of the day, are acknowledging that it's not a unisex job, that you know, sexuality doesn't matter in terms of parenting. It does matter for the same reason that you just described in that scenario. That boy needs his father to have as that resource to go through that puberty or to go through that adolescent experience.
So how about Dr. Paul Holtorf? In these days, that model we talked about is gone now.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the case is far more true today than it was, say, 30 years ago there at Concordia Seward.
Mm-hmm.
That the kids who there are products of broken homes. They have their parents, then they have step-parents, or maybe they don't have a father, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually they wind up in your classroom, many of them.
Right.
Do you become a father figure to students at Concordia University?
Yeah, given my age, I'm probably more an uncle figure. But I do wonder about whether or not students perceive me as some kind of family figure that they might be able to relate to. And I do know that students here at Concordia appreciate stories of professors using their families as illustrations, and, you know, good or bad illustrations. But it's a connecting point with students that they can see that life outside the ivory tower and the hallowed halls of Concordia University you know, life exists for this family as well, and to see that, yeah, maybe it's a broken home, or maybe it's, you know, it's an intact home, but nonetheless, it's still a family, and they do ask us about certain questions, and you know, to the best of our ability, we respond and help them out along the way.
So what do you do, Dr. Holtorf, when it comes to your attention that some troubled student is having difficulty with his or her grade
mm-hmm.
in your class? Maybe you get involved a little bit. What's going on? You find out, well, there's a broken family here.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden it dawns on you that they may be looking to you to provide at least some of the stability that's missing because of that unstable family situation.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us we'd exit stage left.
Yeah.
You know, we got enough. You got two kids. You got a wife. You got a job. You've
right.
got a, obviously a church relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your job to be parent to two or three or 10 or 12 students that go through Seward. What do you do?
Well, you leave the door open to them, literally. You leave the door open for them to walk into your office and allow them a chance to express themselves. I think one of the unique features of the campus community here at Concordia Seward is that professors are willing to allow themselves to enter into the life of the student. Students are willing to put before a professor his or her situation, whether it be at home or not. Just in the last couple of years, as a good example of this, I've had students come into my office saying, you know what, Mom and Dad are moving, and when I go home for Thanksgiving or Christmas, it's not going to be the home I know. And these are the kinds of situations that we as professors are called to by virtue of our vocation here to be a part of the life of the students. I don't know of any professor that could really last very long here if he or she wasn't willing to do that. Now, certainly there are boundaries there. That we put up and to allow for some healthy, you know, separation. But at the same time, we're here not just as teachers, but we're here to some degree helping them with life in general.
Now that takes us to the other side of the coin, because I don't know exactly how to broach this subject and do it in a way that is appropriate, but when vulnerable students identify in teachers, father figures or mother figures or some kind of stability that they were not experiencing at home, it opens up a pretty dangerous door.
It does.
I'm looking at a story here. This is in the news, and this is from the Daily Telegraph. And I'll try to keep it, I'll try to stay away from being as graphic as the story is. But the story says, and this came out yesterday, that a married teacher has been charged with 7 counts of statutory rape after allegedly having sex with a 13-year-old schoolboy more than 300 times. Her name is Christine McCallum. She's 29 years old and has apparently been living this double life for almost 2 years. She's a Boston teacher. And some of us are scratching our heads saying, how does this happen? The story here says that this allegedly happened right under her husband's nose. That's what the story says. How does this happen? Well, maybe it happens because vulnerable children of a variety of ages are embraced by teachers who feel sorry for them or want to nurture them or want to protect them, and then you have this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you have to say as a teacher? What, you know, how do the teachers at Concordia Seward protect themselves from this kind of an outcome?
Well, that's a very good question. And as an educator, I always, beginning of the day, ask myself, who am I as a child of God? I am 100%, sinner as well as 100% saint. I'm redeemed in the blood of Jesus Christ. I always want to make sure that I'm aware of there's the evil nature still lurking within me, and to be aware of that, and at the same time know that I'm redeemed. So then when I walk into that classroom each day, I realize that, you know, sin is always knocking at the door, or the potential for that. And I can't speak for all my colleagues here, but I know at least for myself that is what I always go in with that realization. And if there is a, and truly, I think we as educators have the responsibility that if we sense a student idolizing us, or you know, in the sense of putting us on this high pedestal and whatever that might lead to, we as educators have to sit down with that student and say, look, you know, we're not what you think we are, and we're not a replacement for whatever is missing in your life at home. And I think you're correct. As more of this brokenness goes on in our society regarding family, teachers, whether it's preschool to college, we need to be aware that we need to be aware of ourselves first. Before we go into it, the most disastrous thing I can think of is somebody leaving this place from Concordia University still as a very needy person going into and teaching children or teaching kids. That is just a recipe for disaster down the road.
So, fatherhood czar. If Tony Dungy winds up being America's fatherhood czar, what advice would you give him?
I think the first thing is to be involved with his children. As a father, be involved, volunteer. If the boy wants to say, let's go out and shoot some hoops, Dad, do it. But the involvement factor, I think, becomes very strong. As I think back to my dad, and growing up, he was involved in a way, not hovering over, but he was always there, willing to participate if asked. And he always created opportunities for that as well. But, you know, growing up on the farm, you were with your dad a lot. And it wasn't just about, you know, recreation, but it was in the doing of things that, as I look back today, it's still a very cherished memory. So I would say be involved with the kids.
You know, Barack Obama during the campaign made a statement which was pretty direct in the direction of those fathers or those men,
mm-hmm.
who seemed to be in a kind of a recreational way getting women pregnant,
mm-hmm.
and then moving on. Were you encouraged by that?
I honestly did not hear that, so I you know, if that's what was said, then yes, I would support that. Yeah.
All right, let's take our bottom of the hour break. We are talking with Dr. Paul Holtorf. He is a professor at Concordia University in Seward, Nebraska, where it is 1 degree above zero, which makes him jealous of me because it's 6 above zero here. And we have open phones for you, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you think we need a fatherhood czar? Would that be a good idea? Pretty soon we'll have a fatherhood department. And just a whole new place where we can spend government money? I'm not quite sure. Come on in and let us know what you think.
To those who have been caught up by the devil's doubts and the world's denials, come and see. Jesus lives. To those who are confused or who question the love of the Lord, the Holy Spirit says, come and see. Jesus gave his life so you might have eternal life.
Pastor Ken Klaus, this week on The Lutheran Hour.
Sundays at 12:30 and 5 p.m.
The 5th Annual Needs and Resources Forum, sponsored by Lutherans and Medical Missions, will be held March 20th and 21st at the Crown Plaza Hotel, Airport, St. Louis, under the theme Reaching Communities for Christ with Health and Education. It's designed for you if you are a medical or church professional, or if you're one who has an interest in medical mission work. A registration form is available online at www.limm.org.
Where do evolutionists get their facts? That's next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
If you gave a design problem to 10 different engineers to solve, chances are you will not get 10 different solutions. In fact, you are likely to end up with 10 solutions which all look very much alike. Now suppose 10,000 years from now, someone found your 10 sheets of problems. Since they are practically the same, this person might conclude that each of the solutions was offered by the same person. He would account for their differences by saying that as each solution was tried, better ideas were developed. He would conclude that the solution most familiar to his own day was the final and most advanced solution. When evolutionists compare creatures like man with apes, noting the similarities, they are falling into the same trap as our theoretical researcher from the future. Certainly there are some similarities between man and apes. However, the structure of the human eye is most similar to the eye of the octopus. The general pattern of the functional structure of the hemoglobin in human blood differs by only one atom from the chlorophyll found in plants. And the protein in human milk is most like the juice of the soybean plant. Not one of these comparisons offers any evidence for evolution. What they illustrate is that any good designer will solve similar problems with similar designs, and they offer evidence that the creation is the work of a wise and powerful designer.
For a printed transcript of today's program, visit our website at creationmoments.com or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
I'm Diane.
And I'm Roland.
The afternoon show is from 3 to 6, Monday through Friday.
Yes, it is.
On AM 850 KFUO.
And I'm there.
You're there.
And you're there.
Just about every day.
And we have interesting conversation about things contemporary and things theological and maybe give some stuff away.
In other words, we keep you company on your drive home.
Absolutely.
That's basically it.
Getting you home safe. That's our main mission.
The afternoon show, 3 to 6 on AM 850 KFUO.
On the next Adventures in Odyssey, meet Talia.
Hello?
She's used to getting whatever she wants.
Enough chit-chat. Let's go over some rules.
But that was before she came to Odyssey, where her uncle gives her surprise.
What is this stuff?
After surprise.
You cannot possibly expect me to eat this.
After surprise. What's going on? Who is Talia's uncle? Find out on the next Adventures in Odyssey.
Saturday mornings at 8:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This is the Ask the Pastor Hour, or in this case, Ask the Professor. He is Dr. Paul Holtorf, professor at Concordia University in Seward, Nebraska. Dr. Holtorf, I'm going to change the direction here a little bit. You may recall, I assume that you were aware of the uproar that was created when Barack Obama announced that the invocation at his inauguration would be given by Rick Warren. Since that time, there's a woman, a Muslim woman, who has been added to the festivities. A number of rabbis have been named. There are some other Christian denominational type folks that have been involved. What's your take on the inauguration of this president or any president and the inclusion of religious people, religious identities in that process? Would you rather have no religious representation? Would you rather have a diverse religious representation as we're going to have, or some other option? How do you see it?
Well, not appearing to be too simplistic, I would prefer not to have any religious representation, because for the reasons that are kind of being shown forth here with this inauguration. First, you have Rick Warren, who would represent the Christian church. And now you have rabbis, and you have the Muslim faith being represented. And all of a sudden, this goes beyond you know, an understanding of the purpose of being there in terms of religion. It becomes more of a show. I mean, it becomes more of a demonstration of the diversity of religion as opposed to the real purpose of that role or function of that person serving there, either as an inauguration address or a blessing or that type of thing. I tend to see these political things in what Lutherans have typically called the left-hand kingdom, and these are issues of the government. These are issues of society, and religion to the degree that it is so public like that, I'm not sure really has a role or a purpose in an inauguration like this. But hey, I'm probably in the minority on this one, and I'd certainly be willing to listen to others' opinions on it.
What do you say to somebody who says, 40 years ago, Dr. Holtorf, Billy Graham would give the invocation, and that would be it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a Christian nation, and Barack Obama claims to be a Christian. He ought to have a Christian involved, and that ought to be it.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say?
Well, I would take issue with the whole sense of this is a Christian nation. I have a hard time accepting that as a premise to begin with, and the fact that Billy Graham would be the one giving the invocation blessing, to me doesn't say too much about what Christianity represents and is about in a society such as this. I don't remember if this was, I think this might have been a President George W. Bush's inauguration where, the pastor who led that blessing, you know, was very upfront about Jesus Christ and the uproar that caused. But looking back on it, just because there was a Christian person giving that blessing doesn't mean much in terms of what the Christian life is supposed to look like in the daily life. And so I don't think it means much at all that someone would publicly say something as a Christian, as if that's going to make who we are any different than what we were in the past.
Our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Lael is on the line. Hi, you're on the Bible study.
Good morning, Chuck. Thank you for the study, Pastor.
Thank you.
I was just calling and talking about the Father Czar kind of approach. I think in theory it's really a thoughtful thing, but I would be concerned about that on a governmental level. And really, in terms of governmental issues, the support and value of families and children would probably better be used in terms of, you know, the abortion issue. We value life, you know, that we do work, get rid of the abortion issue and the homosexual issue, and that in supporting families, but not just a father czar, which I'm not sure what kind of, you know, what that would look like in terms of governmental direction.
Doctor?
Well, I certainly appreciate the caller's sensitivity to the governmental intervention and, you know, what that would look like shaped based on government policies and that. I'm going to come back to what I said earlier about it. I think what I'm encouraged about is that there's at least an acknowledgement that a father is important, because the voices that often get trumpeted about is that it doesn't matter whether it's a father or a mother. The fact is that this kid has a parent, and it makes it this sort of generic parental obligation. If there was a visible point person like a Tony Dungy that held up the role of fatherhood, I could see some positive things coming out of it because of the fact that fatherhood is being lifted up and being significant, just as motherhood is.
Well, I it's a good point, and I'm not sure if this is exactly what Lael was saying, but if we're going to have a fatherhood czar, then we've got to ask ourselves, what kind of father are we going to promote? We're going to promote the father that Dr. Paul Holtorf defines as a great father based on his understanding of the fourth commandment and the scriptures, or are we going to promote perhaps the father that the culture wants us to promote? And I don't think it's going to be yours.
Yeah. Well, I think too, there are some values that, that all families would hold true, and I would hope that some of those values could be agreed upon even apart from religion, that could be held up within our own communities. And again, to what level or degree religion have a part of that, I would hope that that would be the case. But at the same time, just casting the vision of fatherhood to me is a very intriguing concept.
505-7851-800-730-2727. Here's another caller. Hi, Steve. You're next on the Bible study.
Yeah, I was just curious about prayers and inaugurations and stuff. Was that something that was just started like 100 years ago, or does that go all the way back to the founding of, you know, the country? And if so, would, because I would agree that I don't feel comfortable with having it. I would just rather have not anybody do that anyway, too. But in making a change like that, would there be some kind of statement being made that, hey, you know what, in our founding the country, we were mixing some kingdoms here that we want to get rid of. And I'm just curious about the history of it and what stopping doing it would actually be stating at this point in time. So I'll let you go.
All right.
Does that make sense? Does my question make sense there?
Yes. Yeah, and I don't know the answer to it. It's a great question.
Okay.
But again, I agree, too, that people would see this and perception would be, well, see, there we are. That's the last point. We are now a post-Christian nation, you know, and well, okay, let's stop that a little bit and analyze it, because I'm not sure we're using Christian in the most appropriate way there, or the most definitive way in terms of how Christianity is defined within our society.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, thank you.
And another caller at 505-7851-800-730-2727. Hi, Charles, you're up next.
Yes, good morning, Pastor and Chuck.
Good morning.
I'm sorry to depart from the subject, and I'm also sorry that I'm bringing up rather an obscure passage, not much interest to the listeners, but I wondered if you might have, and not to put you on the spot, but 2 Samuel 24:1, talking about the census that David took of his fighting force. 2 Samuel 24:1 says, "In the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he incited them, incited David to take a census." But in 1 Chronicles 21:1, it says Satan rose up against Israel and incited David to take a census. I realize this kind of putting you on the spot without a research of what's going on here, but do you think that might be a textual variance, or what would your opinion be?
So we're comparing 2 Samuel 24:1 to what? What's the other scripture?
1 Chronicles 21:1.
Mm-hmm. 1 Chronicles 21.
2 Samuel 24:1 and 1 Chronicles 21:1.
Okay, Doctor, you got the question?
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Charles.
Thanks a lot. Is he still on the line?
No, he's not.
Okay, because I've been curious to ask him a follow-up question to that.
He'll probably call back.
Okay. Well, the question I would have to follow up there is he trying to deal with God starting, you know, being the start and impetus of this eventual sin, or is he trying to, you know, kind of look back at Satan as the one trying to start this this temptation? That would be sort of a follow-up question that I would have to him. And my response, if that indeed was the question there, that we know God is not the cause of this kind of temptation or the cause of this sin. Really, Satan is behind this. So it becomes a more difficult question, I think, without the caller on the line.
Well, I see here that in my Bible it says that for verses 1 through 25 in chapter 24 of 2 Samuel, see 1 Chronicles 21, 1 through 28. So would it be correct to say from a scholarly perspective that these are comparative passages, these are passages talking about the same thing?
Yeah. Yeah, they are, and again, I think as you take a look at these two texts in context here, we can also see that God consistently is not one who causes the sin that way. So I feel more comfortable with seeing this as something coming from Satan than from God.
Okay. All right. Let me go back to the conversation we were having before about the multicultural nature,
mm-hmm.
or the diversity of religious presence at the inauguration. And I want to tie that into a story that comes from the AP on, I guess it was Tuesday of this week, out of Vatican City. Now, the headline is Rabbis in Italy commenting on the Pope canceling progress. And the story says, Italy's rabbis said Tuesday they were pulling out of the Italian Catholic Church's annual celebration of Judaism, saying recent decisions by Pope Benedict XVI were negating 50 years of interfaith progress. The chief rabbi of Venice, Ilia Enrico Ricchetti, cited the Pope's decision to restore a prayer for the conversion of Jews deemed offensive to Jews in Easter week services of the old Latin Mass. In an article published Tuesday in the Italian Jesuit magazine Popoli, Ricchetti said the Assembly of Italian Rabbis felt the prayer and subsequent comments by church officials about the controversy showed a lack of respect that was necessary for dialogue to continue. Here's a quote, if we add to this the recent positions taken by the Pope about dialogue, said to be useless because the superiority of the Christian faith is proven anyway, then it's evident that we're heading toward the cancellation of the last 50 years of church history, he said. Bishop Vincenzo Paglia, who heads the Italian Bishops' Commission on Interreligious Dialogue, said the history of Jewish-Catholic relations cannot just be canceled. If there are difficulties, which undoubtedly there are in Italy, they should become an occasion to recast the dialogue even more strongly. Back in 2007, Benedict relaxed restrictions on celebrating the old Latin Mass, also known as the Tridentine Rite, mm-hmm. which was celebrated before the liberalizing reforms of the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s paved the way for the new Mass used widely today in local languages.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm reading this correctly, this revision, or this return to some previous form, liturgical
right.
form, includes a prayer in a certain setting for the conversion of Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
that really puts the Christianity into the public square, doesn't it? Now?
Yes, it does.
And it really puts in the spotlight now, what is the purpose of the Christian church? Is it about the Great Commission, Matthew 28? Is it about proclaiming Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior? And I think that becomes a very challenging message for others to consider. Now, does it warrant canceling conversations and dialogue? Well, then my question is, well, what do you mean by dialogue then? Because if we're dialoguing, is there some outcome that you want? Do you want outcome as being universal or being on par with, the same as Christianity and Judaism? Is that what you want? Because dialogue needs to be defined there. And I think when people walk away from dialogue, it's because they realize that the outcome that's really discussed here isn't the one they want. They want more an equalization, as if Judaism is as the same as Christianity. And it doesn't sound like Pope Benedict is went that way.
Well, maybe I'm overestimating myself, but I think that if in a synagogue a rabbi was praying for the salvation of my soul, or not my soul individually,
mm-hmm.
but Christians,
mm-hmm.
so that I could see my way past the error of believing in Jesus of Nazareth as Messiah, I wouldn't be offended by that.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Jewish rabbi praying in a synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to have dialogue with that rabbi and explain to him where I'm coming from and listen to him where he's coming. I would love to do that.
That's correct.
I'm not offended by that. How is it that we've come to this place where we're all offended by each other so much and we can't talk to each other if... You know, if you're going to actually hold the things that you claim to be true, Dr. Holtorf, then we just, I can't talk with you.
Right.
Do you see a way out of this dark cave?
No, I don't.
Well, that's not too encouraging.
Well, you know, I put it in the context here. You know, I believe Scripture does not allow women to be ordained clergy. But as I tell students, I said, if I'm in a ministerial alliance in my community and there are women pastors, I still talk to them.
Yeah.
You know, I still show the respect and that is theirs because of what role they're serving in that particular congregation. There's almost this sort of dual or both and kind of thinking we have to start to foster, Chuck. In the church, that on the one hand, no, I don't believe everything you're saying or accept it as articles of faith. At the same time, I'm also going to keep talking to you. And what has happened, I think, in our society is we have forgotten that last part, to continue to dialogue or to continue to talk, not for the sake of conversion or proselytizing, but for the sake of just getting a better understanding. I mean, I can have a conversation with, on my wife's side, you know, kind of, but you know, he comes from the Jewish Reformed background. I can have a dialogue with him in conversation, and we can have a wonderful conversation. But at the end of the day, I'm not changing him in his religious view, and he's not going to be able to change me. And somewhere in our culture, we have to allow for that tension, that it's okay to some degree. If we walk away from the table not agreeing.
I don't understand how it is, you know, I don't know if you have any particular sports affiliations or affections, but around these parts, if you're a Cardinal fan, you probably don't have much affection for Cub fans.
I am a Cardinal fan, and I would agree with that, yes.
But you know what? If a Cub fan comes into St. Louis to attend a Cub game, and he has the audacity to wear his Cub hat and his Ryan Sandberg jersey, that's kind of what I expect from him. He's a Cub fan.
That's right.
And, I'm not going to root for his team. He's not going to root for mine, but we can sit in the stadium next to each other and have a fine old time. I don't understand how it is that these rabbis in Italy think that if the Roman Catholics there in Venice pray for the conversion of Jews, that, well, we just can't talk anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very mature, it seems to be. But now, I don't know, am I wrong?
No, you're not, and I think that comes across the ocean to America, too. I think we find ourselves with that, even within Christianity, Chuck, that if it's a particular denomination is not a part of mine, that somehow I'm not going to talk to you. This again, how we resolve that, I'm not sure, other than to get to know the person, you know, and talk, and at the end of the day, you know, shake hands and know that you would expect it from that person to say that. I think that the other thing, like, that's a great analogy with the Cubs fan, by the way, is because if he didn't act like a Cub fan, then we'd wonder, well, what does he really believe in?
Well, I wouldn't respect him.
Yeah, you wouldn't respect him.
I see, you're not a very good Cub fan.
Right.
I'd expect him to at least be as energetic and enthusiastic about his identity and his commitment as I am to mine.
Right.
But then now that brings us back to the inauguration, because one of the speakers who's going to be at the Lincoln Memorial during the inauguration is Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson,
mm-hmm.
the first openly gay Episcopal bishop who will do a prayer at the Lincoln Memorial at an inaugural event.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that has stirred up some controversy. Robinson, who is 61, said both Obama and Vice President-elect Joe Biden will attend that event. Obama is expected to speak. As for himself, Robinson said he does not yet know what he'll say, but he knows this. He won't use a Bible.
Hmm.
The quote from Robinson is, while that is a holy and sacred text to me, it is not for many Americans. I will be careful not to be especially Christian in my prayer. This is a prayer for the whole nation.
Hmm.
What do you make of that?
I make that there's a confusion of what religion is today, and I think it's a sad commentary on maybe where religion is today in America. And this is why I would prefer not to have any affiliation, given the culture and climate of today, because this is what you're going to end up with. You're going to end up with Rick Warren, who is somehow is the anointed evangelical Christian pastor of America, and then you have these others, and what gets lost is the essence of Christianity. That's what gets lost.
Well, I don't know. I'm just sitting here thinking this through. We're talking about the Episcopal Church, long-time denomination, emerging from a biblical perspective at one time, I guess, which now has a most prominent spokesperson at maybe the most important event over the last 4 years in this country,
mm-hmm.
who says that talking about the Bible or from the Bible is not appropriate. It's just not adding up for me.
Yeah.
But I feel like I must be the one who's out of step here. It seems like everybody else is in step. I must be the one who is confused.
Well, I'll join you in your confusion and being out of step. How's that?
Well, then that makes us brothers in cold and brothers in confusion.
That's right.
So, is this on the minds of the students at Concordia Seward? Are they excited about the inauguration? Are they paying attention to it? Have they thought some of these things about religious presence?
No, I've not heard it, but this is our first week back, and students are trying to get through their first week of
classes. Well, maybe you can use this program as a kind of a springboard to start a big stink there at Concordia Seward.
If I start a big stink, I'll blame you and let you know how it come out.
Give them my email address. I'd be happy to hear it.
I'll do that.
It's been a joy talking to you, brother. Stay
Same
warm,
here.
Whatever it takes, and we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you. Blessings, Chuck.
That is the Reverend Dr. Paul Holtorf. He is professor at Concordia University in Seward, Nebraska, and a man with keen insight and awareness with young people, which is an important thing these days. We'll talk with Pastor Chris Agnew next time on the Bible study as we finish the book of James, chapter 5, verses 7 through 12. And I'm going to save my Tony Dungy Fatherhood Czar story for our Ask the Pastor guest tomorrow, because his church, Mount Olive Church, Lutheran Church in Greenwood, Indiana, is very close to Indianapolis. That'll be Pastor Jeff Alexander. Let's see what he thinks about the Fatherhood Czar. Thanks for listening.
Listen to Chuck Ratherton guests Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study.